Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Cultimatum Podcast, the culture of cults and human trafficking. And my name is Anonymous Andrew. And today I am joined by my co-host, Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hello, Andrew. Thank you. And today we are joined by Beth Granger, an author, advocate, and survivor of the Community of Jesus Church, or cult, we'll call it. She was raised within the church's strict environment. Beth spent 31 years of her life deeply entrenched in the teachings before making the courageous decision to leave. She's now not only sharing her story, but also fighting for justice, helping to spearhead a class action lawsuit against abusers within the organization. Beth is also an author of Born and Raised, a powerful memoir where she sheds light on her experiences. We're honored to have her here with us today. Beth, welcome to Cultimatum.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here. And I was delighted by your text. I had never even heard of your podcast until recently. And I've been listening to it ever since.
Oh, wow. Oh, great. Thank you. We appreciate that.
Good. Yeah.
It's really compelling. So I'm happy to be here.
We're fairly new on the scene. We haven't even been on the air a year, but I think that's coming up soon. So
it is. It's coming up.
Yeah. All
You're
right.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
So my story. I should actually just change. You mentioned that I was part of the Community of Jesus. It's actually more to the story. The Community of Jesus is a cult in Cape Cod. And I was born at a boarding school, an elite private boarding school in Canada called that actually changed its name after I was born, but it was called Grenville Christian College. And it was advertised to be Anglican. And in truth, it was a cult hiding in plain sight. What happened was when I was three, the mothers, two leaders of the commune from Cape Cod, our school fell prey to their influence, if you will. Because of them, Grenville, the school I was at, became an institution of paranoia that brainwashed, abused, and terrorized its residents for decades. So that sort of sets the scene. I was the first baby born to staff members at the school. And so I was called a staff kid. My brothers were already in existence when my parents moved into when my parents joined as teachers there. Yeah. And the school then went bankrupt. Like, fast forward, the school went bankrupt about 5 years after I escaped. To make a long story short, you mentioned I spearheaded a lawsuit. I don't know if you mentioned that, but I helped spearhead a lawsuit 5 years after I'd left. I joined, or was it 6 years? Anyway, I joined a small team of people who we basically, anyway, we'll get to that story, but that's kind of to round out what you said in the introduction. And that lawsuit, I might as well say, it lasted 16 years, and we became the first historical abuse case to win a trial in Canada. So it was a long ordeal, and I have written the story. And, you know, because in my book, I was there for 30 years, but then I've been working at recovery for the next, 25 years. I'm 50, almost 55 now. So yeah, there's a lot more to say, but that's kind of like the Coles notes, if you will.
Right. Right.
Did you, I'm not sure where we should start with,
I'd be curious to hear your childhood.
Yeah.
Let's start there. So you said you were born to staff members, and I would imagine as staff members, they were part of the church.
So, my parents, they wanted to be missionaries originally, and a lot of the staff were brought in under the, they were gung-ho for winning students to Christ and also teaching them, giving them a good education. When the mothers appeared on the scene, I was 3 years old, and the school had been flailing, financially. And they were looking for leadership and guidance and structure from outside sources. And the mothers had established a community in Cape Cod that appeared to be very successful, full of dynamic outreach and people who were very dedicated. So they were able to preach and teach the staff at Grenville. And right away, they started giving them all kinds of prophecies. Yeah, they said that they were hearing directly from God, that this school was destined to be one of the most important Christian education centers in the world. And if the staff would only just follow their lead and commit for life, take lifetime vows of obedience, that, you know, they would form one of the most dynamic, dedicated, and effective teams of Christian education in the world, and that the school would prosper. So that seemed pretty good to the staff who were there, and they bought into it, and they subjected themselves to harsh teaching. Basically, they were told that they were rebellious, and they were all not, actually going the right direction. So the mothers sort of made them, coercive control right off the bat is what happened. The buy-in, as I said, was that they were excited to make the school a place that would succeed. It worked. Like, our school actually grew and developed into a very prestigious institution. The staff were incredibly dedicated. They, like all cult leaders, a lot of cult members, they were very smart, had good intention. They wanted to provide excellent education for students. And it appeared to be a school that anybody would want to send their kids to. In fact, we benefited by having the backing of three different lieutenant governors of Ontario. We had a senator on our board. We had, the bishop, the Anglican bishop of Ontario on our board. But all these people didn't know what was really going on. All they saw were students who seemed to be very well disciplined and students who seemed to be happy and engaged. But the truth was a different story. And so I guess I'll get into that next. But I've kind of laid the scene. It's like why anybody would join and why my parents bought into this. The real story was that there was a motto that they didn't, make public, which was, we're going to break you down and build you up the Grenville way. And this was accomplished through an all-you-can-eat buffet of coercive tactics. Number one, light sessions. The mothers right off the bat demonstrated and used this tactic. It was basically public shaming sessions where people were attacked for their sins, both real or imagined. You never knew if you'd be next. And they did this within the staff, and they basically made the staff become perfected at the tactic amongst themselves. And then they started applying it to the students. And these are students who are paying $20,000 per year to be educated there. But yet they're having to go through these sessions. Sometimes the sessions were just small groups behind closed doors. Other times they were the full school. So we're talking hundreds of people where any student would be stood up and attacked for their perceived sins. And then, you know, on top of that, within the staff and the staff kids, there were about up to about 100 staff. It was a big, you know, a big group of people. And they dismantled families. So right off the bat, they removed staff kids like me from our parents and told our parents that they were blind to our sin and that they needed to eradicate their sin of idolatry, putting anyone before God. So we were moved away from our parents and not allowed to be raised by them. However,
what age was that?
So I was 4 when I was moved away from my parents. And, you know, looking back, I realized I learned that it was a sin to love me. And if you really think about that, imagine the damage that that has to a child. It's hard to quantify.
So they literally removed you from your parents at the age of 4. And where did you go to?
So I was passed from family to family. Made to live with a family in the staff residence, but, you know, several floors below where my parents lived. And I wasn't allowed to talk to my parents or go to see them for my needs. I was told that this was my new family. And then I was passed from family to family. One thing they did, and I could get to this later, was they controlled our every move. And by move, I mean they moved us a lot too. Like you were never allowed to get comfortable or feel like, you know, just get comfortable where you lived, even in your residence. So yeah, that was a huge problem, a huge tactic, I should say. And then there was a spy network that I never really saw until we went through the lawsuit. But it was top down for the leaders to the staff kids, and then prefects who were students that were kind of molded to be part of this network. And everyone was responsible for turning people in for breaking a long list of rules, like that were written and unwritten rules. So you could get, well, we'll get into the rules later, but you know, there were tons of rules things that you couldn't do, like you couldn't listen to music, you couldn't even have a Walkman or even cassette tapes or anything like that. But you could also be turned in for having a bad attitude. So it was all subjective. And that leads to the next thing, which was the disciplines were incredibly punitive, harsh, and unpredictable. And I could talk about the disciplines all day, but I'll shorten it to, it was anything from hard labor. If you were put on discipline, you were pulled out of school, taken out of the uniform. We all wore uniforms all the time, but you couldn't wear one when you were on discipline. So everyone could see that you were on discipline, and you were given hard labor, and you were never told how long it would last. That was the killer. Like, you were working from 6 a.m. to maybe 9 p.m. at the dirtiest, most demeaning jobs in the school. And they told you this would last indefinitely until you had changed, according to their subjective decision, you know. But they also used the paddle. Kids could be paddled severely. And this was a huge part of our lawsuit because it was so severe. And then there were so many random disciplines, like a girl could have her hair cut short because she was being a temptress. That happened to me, actually. And then I told you we had a long list of rules, but you could get paddled or disciplined for not turning someone in or sinning in your mind, as they called it. You just never knew. You weren't safe. Is basically the issue. And even like I was smart enough to follow the rules but I got disciplined all the time because of my perceived bad attitude or my haughtiness, or you just were never safe. You couldn't just think, okay, I'm going to play the game and I'm going to stay out of trouble. It didn't work that way. They were trying to break us down, basically.
It almost sounds like they would find a reason.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. For example, when I was in grade 9, I mean, this was another discipline that didn't hurt anyone but me, but I was not allowed to see my grades for all of high school because they said I was too haughty. They wanted to obliterate my ego. And that's so weird in a school where performance was everything, right? And that was the other thing. They wanted to make sure, and I said before, we were to be broken down. So well, anyone who was doing well.
What is haughty?
Haughty? Egotistical, basically. You know, someone who thinks they're better than others. So.
And who would determine that about you?
Oh, well. That's a good question, because it wasn't just the leaders. They taught all staff to turn on each other and to turn on staff kids and to attack, like root out sin, right? So we're always focusing on repentance. And if you're not continually repenting and looking at where you're wrong and where you're sinful, then there's something off. And that was the huge put, like that was the goal and the focus of our life. And light sessions were just one way of uncovering that sin. But it was really a mind fuck because, as I said, we were being taught, like one of our mottos, the big motto, which was public, was excellence to the glory of God. Everyone was pushed to do so well within the school. I mean, picture a private boarding school where every opportunity is provided, everything from every kind of musical program to like stage productions to sports teams to public speaking. We had it all. But if you started doing well, you were brought down a peg. And by brought down, I mean people who were really good at music were all of a sudden not allowed to do music anymore. It was just so difficult to handle. And one, you know, another discipline that they started when I was 5, I was put on my first diet, and that has haunted me for my whole life. I've been battling eating disorder, and yet, I can't remember where I was going with that.
All right. What kind of diet?
Oh, you know, just like to lose weight. I can't remember. I remember I wasn't allowed to have desserts, and I have very distinct memories from kindergarten going to a birthday party where I was off campus and I couldn't wait to have a piece of cake. And, you know, just like it's clear as a bell in my mind. But I remember back then thinking if I lose weight, maybe they'll let me live with my parents like that. They didn't, by the way. No. But basically, I guess where I was going with that is constantly trying to break you down, because I finally, it took me about 10 years, but I became anorexic. And then I got in trouble for not eating enough. And they started accusing me of trying to tempt the boys with my, you know, skinny body. So then they force fed me, and then I became bulimic, and then I got in trouble for eating too much. Like, you could never win, right? So that's just part of the discipline aspect. It was just a constant, everyone was trying to be broken. And I look at back at the mother's teaching, their core philosophy was death to self. You know, the key is death to self. And they would preach that we are nothing, and of ourself we can do nothing. That they also preach that all human love is sin before God. So they were constantly trying to break down relationships, bonds, even not just between children and parents, but even students, like boarding students, were not allowed to be close to each other, even girls with girls. I have a really good friend who I've made friends since we left the school. And anytime she got close to another boarding student, they would separate them. They would take them out of their same classes. They would move them in in the dorms, just trying to make sure that everyone was isolated enough so they could be manipulated, I think, and to make sure that people were just, their spirits were broken so they could be controlled, I think, is what was going on. It's really hard to understand, but
it sounds awful. Like,
yeah,
Yeah.
Yeah.
When, so you were, I just want to go back to your, the fact that they took you from your parents. When, so that was around four, I think you said?
I was, when,
yeah. Yeah. When was the next time you saw them? Or did you?
I would see them.
Allow them visitation?
We were living on campus, and I didn't mention this before, but you couldn't work as a staff member unless you lived on campus and unless you took vows for life. That was the deal. So, and we had close to 100 staff members in our heyday. So a lot of people bought into it. But so we would live in different places on campus. They had a whole set of trailers at one point. They also had staff residence that they built along as the years went by. And I would see my parents in the hallways. I would see them, you know, we always ate in the big dining room with everyone. All the students and staff ate together. So I would see them across the dining room once in a while, you know, at Christmas or Thanksgiving. I would sit at their table for a special occasion. But we didn't live together except one year when I was 11, which was a wonderful year. And I wrote about it in the book. Like it was everything I wished for. And then we got moved again. The dismantling families. I mean,
you mentioned having brothers. I assume you were separated from your brothers as well. Were they just given to different families?
Yes, they were. Yeah, they were. I had one brother was 2 years older and the other was 4 years older. And then when I was eight, my mother had her fourth child. And for 6 months, I write about this too. For 6 months, I was allowed to live with them once the baby was born. And then for some unknown reason at the time, my mother was deemed to be too sinful and she was shipped off to the Community of Jesus with my baby brother. And so I had to live without seeing them for the better part of 3 years. It just never ended. You never felt like you were acceptable or your parents were acceptable. I watched them being publicly shamed so much that I realized like it was dangerous for me to show them love and it was dangerous for them to show me love. That answers that question.
And I have so many. Oh, geez. So I don't know the laws in Canada, and I don't know even here in the United States, to have a child removed from the family, even in a religious organization. I mean, legally, they couldn't do that.
It never occurred to me if that's legal or not. It surely shouldn't be.
Unless your parents sign something when they...
Exactly. I mean, I'm sure the experts know how incredibly damaging it is, but it took me, you know, years of struggling after I left to realize how much it had damaged me.
Well, here's the problem with that situation is that you're talking about under the guise of a cult, which all the people are under the illusion of the cult belief. So they're going to comply whether it's legal or not. I know from my cult experience, a lot of women that weren't complying with the multiple marriage teaching, one of the punishments they used was taking their children away. You are unrighteous and you are unholy. And so you are not, your influence is going to influence your children and it's going to make them sin. So we're going to take your children away and we're going to give them to somebody else. And nobody questioned that. They just complied because when you're in that cult mindset, you believe you're doing the right thing for the right reasons. And you believe you are sinful. You believe you deserve whatever you're getting. So you take it and you don't think, oh, maybe this is illegal. You just go by the church doctrine rather than the law.
Absolutely. I mean, you get it. That's exactly what is going on. And people are not questioning and they are completely full of shame and basically barely surviving. And so, you know, my parents have apologized to me many times since. And and it's hard because I get it. I forgive them, but I also, I hate to say this, don't really have a connection with them. Like it was broken. And you can't manufacture that years later.
By design, it was done. That was actually one of the questions I wrote down that I was going to ask you toward the end is how was your relationship with your parents and were you able to mend that? And I'm sure there is still a lot of even if you were able to forgive them and you're able to move past it, there's still years of bonding that were stolen from you and from them that you can't get back.
Exactly.
Once it's gone, it's gone.
Exactly. And you can't pretend. I mean, I've tried. To answer that question, it's a work in progress. We've helped them a lot, because when the school went bankrupt, my parents were still living there along with all the other staff who had been promised room and board for life, and they had been paid very little all those years. So here they were stranded, basically. So my husband and I have been helping them with housing ever since. But the actual bonds and the feeling of love is still, it's a painful thing. And my brothers, we all have shattered relationships. So it's, one of my brothers is still a monk at the Community of Jesus. He's been there. I'm 55. He's 57. He's been there since he was 21. And that was another way they controlled us, was that not only did you have to take vows of obedience for life, but many people were told that God had called them to be a brother or a sister, which was a monk or a nun.
Question. So The school went bankrupt and closed, but the church didn't, because if he's a monk, he's somewhere practicing this.
Yes. I call it the headquarters or the mother house. They're still in operation in Cape Cod. The school was, the headquarters didn't run the school day to day. What they did was they appointed leaders for the Canadian school. And there were two sets of leaders, husband and wife teams, and they were the headmasters, and they became our own cult leaders. So they basically were the spokespeople for the mothers, if you will, and they just carried out all the policies and dictates that the mothers taught them. So we learned to be just as afraid of our headmasters as we were of the mothers.
Let's jump to your teenage years. And I'm guessing that it was as horrible during your adolescent years and 15, 16, 17, 18, when you ultimately graduated, I guess at 18, from their version of high school. And did they have a college that you went to?
Well, first of all, when I took on the lawsuit, and this is jumping around, but 7 years after I left, I took on the lawsuit and I realized I had dissociated so much through high school. I could barely remember it. It was that bad. But ever since, and having written the book, I can remember a lot more. In high school, it was very intense. We staff kids were expected to be the spies within the dorms, and we were held to a very high standard. And I was really trying to do the impossible, which was walk a tightrope between being friends with the boarding students who were normal and also being acceptable by the staff who wanted me to be, a spy. And trying to do that was really hard. I was trying to have my foot in both worlds. And as a result, I got in trouble constantly for being rebellious and haughty and having a bad attitude, and it was like I had a target on my back. And they finally, I was 16, and it was found out that I had a crush on a boarding student. And I won't go into all the details in my book, but I was expelled and sent down to the Community of Jesus indefinitely, where I was not allowed to be educated. I didn't get to go to school there. And I worked like a slave, basically. I missed, a good portion of a whole school year. When I came back, when they allowed me finally to come back, and I'd basically been completely brainwashed, listening to mothers teaching tapes all day long while I'm working and completely in isolation, not allowed to write home. I came back for grade 12 and I was basically a shell of my former self. Like, I just was so scared and so paranoid that I just would not put a step out of line. But I continued to have to undergo intense interrogations and light sessions and disciplines. One of the reason for that was they were molding us staff kids to become staff, and they wanted us to just leave high school and go right into the workforce, the staff, and buy into everything and take our vows of lifetime obedience. And I didn't question it. You know, if we left, we were shunned and we were told we were going to hell. And some people did try to leave, and everyone talked about them as if they had, you know, I pictured them on the streets basically selling their bodies, you know, if they're a woman. And so it worked. I was completely unable to imagine leaving. You know, so, I get into, there's so much more to the story, but, you know, read the book.
Oh, yeah.
But then so, there's more when I'm at a high, when I'm in my 20s, and I want to get to that. But I don't
know. Yeah. So let's jump ahead to that, because we're talking 35 years that you were in. So we can't cover that in an hour. So,
yeah. So,
especially
my 20s,
you wrote a book.
Yeah. So my 20s, it was more of the, I don't know, I don't know if I mentioned, you know, just so many cruel and unusual disciplines. They just kept getting worse, you know.
But let me ask you this. At some point, I understand that at 16, they don't want you to have a crush on a boy or be close to other. But when you turn 18, don't they, isn't the world, that's the way it works, that you become 18, 19, you find a husband or wife and you marry. So,
oh, good question. We weren't allowed to marry anyone outside of the group.
Of course.
So
how silly.
The problem was I was one of many girls and there were very few guys. And so by early 20s, I could see the writing on the wall. There weren't very many guys and none of them were interested in me. So by the time I was 26, I actually got engaged to, it's a whole story, but there was a man who I was working with closely in the finance department. And he was 11 years older than me and I was not at all interested in him. But he met with me and some of the higher ups and told me that he felt God was calling us to be a couple. And I resisted. I had no desire to date him, even though I was desperate to not be a spinster. Anyway, what happened was we got engaged eventually. I turned out I liked the feeling of someone liking me or loving me, you know. It was kind
of... Well, sure, you didn't have that for 25 years.
Exactly. So I fell in love with the notion of being in love. I didn't... He was not the right match, but I didn't really have any other choices. So when he broke up with me out of the blue, just months before we were to get married, I was shocked, devastated. Those aren't even enough words to cover it. I went into a deep depression and I realized not only was I not getting married there to anyone because there were no other men, but I was pushing 30 by then when he broke up with me and I was a virgin. And, you know, this is hard to take, to know that you're stuck there as a beast of burden with not being able to be a mom, not being able to be married. And I just started to realize I might never be happy here. And that felt like a very rebellious thought, because I had been trained no matter how hard life is, that was where I was meant to be. And that was where God called me to be. But I started realizing, I don't know if I can do this. And side note, that fiance went on to be a brother, a monk at the Community of Jesus, and he's still there to this day. After that, I started to, it was kind of like I needed to feel loved and I needed to have that little taste, and then I needed it taken away for me to realize I can't do this. Because without that love, without that taste of what it was like to have that hope.
Human connection.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So at the age of, let's just fast forward to 30. Let's say you turn 30 and you're not a child anymore. So you said that you couldn't date outside the church. I'm guessing you were working still at the church or.
This is a private boarding school and we're all living there on campus and working. And,
did you have a car?
Good question. So right around that time, there's so much to cover, but what should I say? What happened was just after he broke up with me, two things happened. One was the headmaster, who was the most cult leader-like, if you will. He retired. It was 1997, and I don't know that it was his choice, but things were changing, and I think they realized the school was in danger of folding if things didn't start to, if rules didn't start to get completely changed, because I think they were losing enrollment and money. And anyway, he retired, and when that happened, we started having all kinds of rule changes. Like, I got my first pair of jeans at age 27, and they started allowing staff to buy cars if they could afford them. Now, we weren't paid very well, but my grandfather had died several years earlier and left me money. So when I got a car of my own, and I had knee surgery, which is so innocuous, but what happened was I needed to go to physio. And they gave me permission to go off campus to physio. And then the doctor ordered me to keep it up with Aquafit. I all of a sudden was able to go off campus because of that. And I had a car, and I started to get strong, fit, and I started to meet people and make friends. And then it was like this whole sort of the roof kind of opened up, and I started to feel like a caged animal in my life on campus, and I started questioning everything.
The critical thinking kicked in.
Exactly. And then when they kept up all the stupid light sessions where they're, you know, giving me grief for all my sins, for the first time in my life, I started thinking, instead of thinking shame, feeling shame and listening to them and believing them, I started getting angry and thinking, they were full of shit.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And not only that, I started, you know, not always did I think they were full of shit. There were a couple times, and it was one part in my book that, like, I realized they were lying to me. You know, they were accusing me of a sin that the day before they had said the opposite. And I lost my cool in a big way. What happened was eventually I left. It took me 3 years to decide that it was more important for me to leave than the fear of hell. Like, I couldn't worry about hell anymore. I had to, for my own sanity and for my
own. Let me ask you a question. And Melody, please jump in, but I do have a question. So after your knee surgery and you were in physical therapy, mm-hmm. you started to see the world outside this campus. Right. So you said the critical thinking kicked in, I guess, slowly but surely. Did you see that there was a whole world out there that did not think and act and behave and live the way you did?
Oh, yes. And interestingly enough, I was brought up in a cult, but we had outside students come in and we lived with them. For 30 years, I was rubbing shoulders with normal students who were only there for a year or two or three. So that whole time I was aware of the outside world, very, very aware. I was actually very curious about it, but I was also scared of it. So when I finally decided I have to leave, it was because I saw myself as a black sheep in a white flock. And I knew that I was not buying in anymore, even though I saw myself as the problem and I was the failure, not them. And when I left, I wasn't at all aware that they were a cult. I had no idea they had been abusive. I just knew that I wasn't happy. And I knew that I couldn't keep up this sort of facade of being buying into everything anymore. It took me years to understand that it had been, number one, a cult, number two, incredibly damaging to thousands of people, and then number three, what to do about it. So that actually happened, you know, years after I'd left.
So walk us through you actually leaving.
Well, the actual leaving I did in stages. I was very, I was kind of like, what's the word? Not methodical. This is another word. I was scared to lose my security and all the people I knew. So my first step was I asked a special permission for them to let me move off campus, but keep working there because I had a specialized job in the finance department. So they granted that, which was very unusual at the time. And then once I was living in the nearby town, I started meeting people, and those people started helping me see that I was not obligated to stay there for life, that it would be fine if I actually went to university and got my teaching degree. Because it's funny, I actually became a teacher, and they had told me, the leaders at Grenville, which is so crazy. Here we are running a very good boarding school. They did not want me to be a teacher because they said that that would mean I'd be too haughty. That's that haughty word again. And I would be not low enough, that I needed to be basically
humbled
and broken.
Yeah.
And if I was a teacher, I would think too well and too high of myself. And yet here I was, a very academic oriented person, and I would have been an excellent teacher at the school, but they wouldn't lie. You know, it just all ridiculous.
Well, you got out of that echo chamber and you had the influence of outside people. Basically, you were hearing something other than what you had heard your whole life. So you had this other influence, and it was making a huge difference in your ability to critically think and look at the group from another perspective, which is, exactly. You know, awesome that you were able to do that and able to get yourself. But I love how you were able to do that in stages and get yourself out of that situation. And you have to, you know, a lot of times that's why they have the term, and the Jehovah's Witnesses use it. Have you heard the term PIMO? You might have
heard it
on our podcast. Yes. Physically and mentally out. I'm sure you spent a lot of time in PIMO when you were there, where you were physically still stuck in the situation and you had to mentally figure your way out. How am I physically going to get out of here? I mentally already left, but I got to physically figure out how to get out of here.
That's exactly what it was like. Yeah. And it took, like I said, it took me 3 years before I realized the steps I needed to take and also get the courage to do it. Because once I left, I was all alone. I didn't have my support system, and I was really scared. But I did have a few people who had helped me on the way out. And I also, there was a man involved too, but that was a short term thing. But I write about him. He was quite a special guy.
but you said that you are currently married.
Yes. So that man was just a, you know, I think the universe provides people along your
a
path,
stepping
right?
stone.
You know,
he was, absolutely.
He was the most unlikely person you would ever match me with, but he set me straight in so many ways. I remember him yelling at me, "Lady, you don't owe that place one fucking thing," you know? and it took me
good
so long to understand that he was right. But yeah, we didn't end up together, which was fine. But yeah, I met a man online soon after I left, that guy. And we're still married. He was a police sergeant in Ottawa, and we've built a life. And you know, fast forward, I left and everything seemed going like it was going well, and I was putting the past behind me successfully, right? And that's why one of the reasons I wrote my book was that I wanted to show people you can't do that. Like even me, like I had the $1 million family. I had a boy and a girl and a good husband and a nice home and the dream job, and your trauma catches up with you. You know, even if you're like me and you're an overachiever and you think you can just achieve your way out of the past. And so, yeah, it caught up with me in a big way, kind of brought me to my knees a few years ago, which all coincided with our lawsuit going to trial. It's a big story. I know we don't have much time to get all into it, but I don't know if you have any leading questions that can focus me on that point.
So you mentioned family. I think you said children, right? So you have two kids?
I do. They're 18 and 20 now.
Wow. Good for you.
Thank you.
Okay. While you were talking, just amazing. Are there any documentaries about this cult?
Yes.
That you're aware of?
Yes. Two investigative documentaries were done. You know, you have 60 Minutes in the U.S. In Canada, we have the Fifth Estate, which did a documentary on the school in 2021. I think it's called The School of Secrets, but I could be wrong. Anyway, it's the Fifth Estate. And we have another documentary that was done by W5, another investigative show in Canada. One of them is called The School of Secrets, and the other is called In the Name of God. And I can't remember which is which, but yeah, those are two documentaries that were done. I wasn't involved in them. I was still too much of a basket case to appear on camera, but they were well done.
One question, and then I'll see if Melody has any. One question that we like to ask our guests towards the end is, where are you today with your faith?
Well, I'm learning to bask in the infinite sea of doubt, I like to say, because I'm too skeptical to go to church anymore. I have, through the years, come to see, you know, not only was my upbringing incredibly damaging, but my gosh, the damage that's being done in churches today is just every day I feel kind of sick about it. And I don't know that I could ever, I never say never, but I'm not sure I'll ever go back and trust religion as per se. You know, I do like to think there's a higher power that wants the best for us, and that is kind of part of our intuition. And, you know, maybe the universe.
You know, Melody, that seems to be the answer we get from every ex-cult member.
There are some that go back to religion, but it's a very, very small portion. And I'm in the same
atheists,
boat as you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
what is the name of your book?
Oh, it's called Born and Raised, R-A-Z-E-D. And the subtitle is Surviving the Cult Was Only Half the Battle.
Wow.
And where can we find your book?
It is, well, I suppose it's anywhere books are sold, but because it's just getting started, the easiest way would be to find it on Amazon. But I think, you know, it can be ordered by any independent bookstore or.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll put an Amazon link in the show notes.
Oh, thanks. That's awesome.
So it was just published recently.
Just this week. Yeah.
So you're beginning your tour, your press tour.
Yes. And the audio book is on its way. It's not quite ready, but I narrated it. And
that was
an emotional experience.
Oh, I bet.
I'm really proud of it, though. I think it's going to be really good. But I mean, we barely scratched the surface of the story, but I hope I've at least piqued people's interest.
I would hope so. I think you have. You've piqued mine.
And this is, like I said before, no way to take 35 years of what you went through and squeeze it into 60 minutes. It took a whole book and to do that, and there's no way we can do that. But what you have shared so far, Melody knows me. I was squirming in my chair just knowing what you went through, and I really applaud you for getting out, stepping forward. Great for the. I'm not going to talk about the lawsuit, but you said that you won, which is a big battle.
Right.
So congratulations on that, Melody. Any parting questions before we say goodbye?
I guess just the typical of if there's any advice that you would give to somebody else who might be in a similar situation that might be listening to us right now and might be finding themselves in a similar situation, on what to do and what would be your advice to them, and or somebody who might be thinking about joining a group. And I know you weren't specifically in that situation because you were born in, but what advice would you give to somebody in those situations?
Well, first of all, we didn't touch on it, but the long road to recovery. I want to say this, like, if you are recovering from a cult, be patient, give yourself so much compassion, because it is a journey of a lifetime. And, you know, if you're like me, you will probably underestimate it and be completely shocked constantly. Like, I thought that was in the past. You know,
right.
It's not in the past. They're the voices of those leaders are in your head. They're trapped there, and they are probably attacking you from the inside. So you need help. So there are many ways to find help. Luckily, like when I left, the internet was just getting going, but now we have so many resources online, podcasts for one thing. I mean, very helpful. Books, memoirs. I mean, I wrote my book because I actually never found a memoir like mine specific. And half of my book is the recovery part. because it's really confusing and so isolating. You just don't know what's wrong with you. So, you know, books can really make a difference. And trust, tap into your intuition. That's another thing. They try to break your intuition. They try to completely dismantle it. And you'll feel, if you are questioning whether you're in some place that you might, you know, start having doubts about, I don't know. Your intuition is a lot stronger than you think, but it's just been completely annihilated by leaders. And I just urge people to try to just follow it, because looking back, it's my intuition that got me out of it. Yeah. It led me all the way through. I guess another is just there are a few books that I thought were really helpful to me. One was by Yanya Lalich, Take Back Your Life. Another, Stephen Hassan. I'm sure everyone mentions that. Combating Cult Mind Control. And recently, Dr. Laura Anderson wrote When Religion Hurts You. That really helped me understand a lot more about religious religious trauma syndrome, which is a thing. So
it is a thing. Yeah.
We hear it every
so,
day.
Yeah,
it's real.
So I hope that helps a little.
Okay, Beth, I love that. Thank you so much for your story, and I wish you the best of luck on your book and best of luck in your life. And it sounds like you're doing well.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming on the show and sharing your story, and wish you all the best with your book, and we'll help promote it too. So, and you can use this podcast to help promote it as well. I mean, use the, when we do the promo video, you can share that on your Facebook page, all that stuff too, which will help promote it too. So we'll help you do that.
I will. Okay. Thank you so much. And thank you for what you're doing in your podcast. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely. Yes. Thank you. And once again, a big, huge thank you to Beth for coming on the show and sharing her very difficult story. And wow, I'm going to be honest with you, Andrew. You hear the name Community of Jesus, and it sounds so benign. It sounds so mainstream. You're thinking, because we've, not to minimize anyone's trauma, but we've done some groups that lean more towards a controlling group and a little less culty. I was really thinking that was the direction we were going to go with this one based on the name of the group.
Yep.
Yes. And it hit all the culty boxes that are there in every way. I mean, yeah, the control, the coercion, the isolation, the abuse. I mean, just you go right down the line, and it ticked all the boxes of being very culty.
And I want to tell the audience that after the interview, we chatted with Beth a little bit longer, and she did mention that there was also sexual abuse that and she just didn't ask, and she didn't bring it up, but she said that was a very big part of it too. So, that's another checkbox that.
Yes. And then, exactly.
It was part of the lawsuit. Yeah.
Yes. The sexual abuse was part of the lawsuit. She did say that after we recorded.
And I've talked about this over the past, I think what are we up to, 50 episodes or 50 something? Over
53 all was of those episodes. Last weekend dropped 53.
All right. Yay.
Yes.
All of those, there was only a handful that had me squirming in my chair. And this one's one of them. For the folks, we did do a video record this time, and you'll get to see some of it in the promos maybe. But Beth seemed to have the body language that I was reading from her, she was still very much traumatized. 35 years from birth all the way up to adulthood of this indoctrination in her. And she was struggling. I can only imagine. Yeah, I can only imagine she had to relive it all over again writing that book. And I saw her struggling.
Yes.
In the interview. And it was tough for her. So I really want to thank Beth very, very much for her courage.
Yes. And the other thing I want to bring up is that she mentioned about the fact, like when we brought up her faith and she was saying that, and she seemed almost hesitant to really say, but basically, and I speak with people, you know, online or offline occasionally on the phone, you know, just as support for people that have come out of cults. And I recently spoke to a younger gal that was struggling, and she asked if I would talk to her, and I did. And she was struggling with some of the same things. Like she said, I don't even know how to answer the question of like what right. I believe right now. And I said, just remember that saying that you don't know or that you're still in the process of figuring that out is an answer.
That's okay.
That's
okay.
Yes.
And it's okay.
It is okay. And I told her, and another answer that's completely acceptable is to say, I don't really want to talk about that. That's an acceptable answer. You can set up that boundary.
Because it's a personal, yeah, it's
absolutely.
Personal. And when you go through the, I'm going to sound like a cult expert now, but going through the deconstruction is, and I don't know what that's like, can be so difficult. And I knowing you now and what you went through, you know, again, the 17 years before you put up a Christmas tree, that's a long time.
That is 17
years.
Time.
Yeah. Yes. That, so she's got even though she's married now with two kids, she's still not quite there yet. And,
no.
and I feel so bad for her.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and you think about it, I was only in my cult for 5 years and I was out for 17 before I put up a Christmas tree. She was born in and there for 31 years or something. And yeah, her deconstruction is going to be a lifelong process. Absolutely.
It is.
And
it
that's
is.
Okay. And she as actually, it's good that she knows that and she's acknowledging that. So, I mean, we wish her all the best. And we do thank her for coming on because it was a very enlightening episode and another group that we haven't covered before or even heard
yes,
of.
Yes, I like that too. A new cult. Yeah.
Yes, a new one. So we are so grateful for her coming on. And we want to thank as well all of you for tuning into Cultimatum. Your support is always appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify, that does really help us out. And don't forget to also follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can connect with us also by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can find us on additional social media platforms, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
And if you have a personal experience with cults or human trafficking that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are an ex-cult member looking for additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
And you can check out my other podcast, the Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast, where we talk all about the modern dating scene, which is pretty messed up. So head over there and check it out. If you'd like to help us with the cost of maintaining the podcast, you can show your support through the Buy Us a Cup of Coffee link in our show notes. Every bit helps in our mission to spread awareness about cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.